Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2018. Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine. Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak. Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, upisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami. Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha. Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Emma Tarlow talking about the international trade in human hair. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, this is, I think this is really interesting. The collection and trade in human hair. This is an international industry worth a load of money, hundreds of millions of pounds across the world. But probably you'd hardly know it exists. You may never have heard of it at all. This is a secretive world, this. And of course, the politics of hair as well, we know. Wigs, weaves, extensions, relaxants, hair dye. It's all out there. Complicated world, this. Emma Tarlow is a professor of anthropology and the author of a book called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. Emma, a warm welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
So let's just talk about, first of all, selling hair. Now, this happens, it used to happen in this country, I think relatively recently. Presumably you were driven to it by poverty, were you?
Yes, on the whole, it used to be sort of poor peasant women in rural areas who were selling their hair, which would be collected up and used for sort of wealthier women's hairstyles. And that was very, very common in the late 19th century. But even in the late 19th century, in somewhere like Britain and Europe, they were looking abroad to places like China for getting more hair, because there was always this sense that there was a shortage of hair. It's not easy to gather. They call it a crop, but right. You can't sort of harvest it like other crops. It's dispersed on different people's heads and people have to be willing to sell it.
There is a particular type of hair that is now the world's most valuable human hair, is that right?
I don't know. I mean, European hair is certainly considered, is generally more expensive, partly because it's more difficult to get hold of,
right.
But also because you have a much wider colour range available. A lot of the hair, the vast majority of hair that's on the market is black hair that's gathered from different Asian countries, and it's almost unanimously black, sometimes with some grey or white in it, and so that's less valorized. And also there are different textures of hair that come from different parts of the world. So the Chinese hair is sort of thicker and straighter, and it's said not to hold the curl as well as other types of hair. But on the other hand, it's very resilient to sort of bleaching and dyeing, so it might end up in a blonde wig in the UK.
Right. I mean, virgin hair is hair that has never been dyed or treated in any way.
Exactly. So that's the phrase that's used and sort of virgin gold would be sort of blonde virgin hair that hasn't been treated at all. And of course, that's difficult to get hold of because many people are dyeing and bleaching their hair. They don't necessarily have long hair in Europe, and also many Europeans don't want to sell their hair, although there is some trade coming in from Russia and Ukraine.
I said it was a secret world. It is actually, isn't it? I mean, there's an example in the book where you visit a very successful Chinese businessman. Mm. And I mean, his business, it isn't shady particularly, but it is secretive.
It is secretive. I think there's partly a slight sort of yuck factor that people are slightly repulsed by the idea of sort of a trade in what is really a kind of body part or
body
product.
It is a body part.
It is a body part. And but there's also, you know, there's a certain amount of shame attached to poverty if you're selling your hair, so you're not going to want to advertise it particularly. And then when you think of hair collectors, they want to sort of keep their sources and supplies of hair, you know, to themselves. Mm. So there's a lot of sort of hiding of sources. Then there's in the factories, you know, you've got companies in competition with each other. They might want to keep their particular recipe for bleaching hair, secret. And then even at the purchasing and incorporation of hair, I mean, some people are wearing hair extensions, but they don't want necessarily for people to know about that. So the secret is kind of built in at all sorts of different levels. And even when hair's in circuit, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about hair theft. So right. there's a lot of different ways in which it's secretive.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Now, this is, I think this is really interesting, the collection and trade in human hair. This is an international industry worth a load of money, hundreds of millions of pounds across the world. But probably you'd hardly know it exists. You may never have heard of it at all. This is a secretive world, this. And of course, the politics of hair as well, we know. Wigs, weaves, extensions, relaxants, hair dye. It's all out there. Complicated world, this. Emma Tarlow is a professor of anthropology and the author of a book called Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. Emma, a warm welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
So let's just talk about, first of all, selling hair. Now, this happens, it used to happen in this country, I think relatively recently. Presumably you were driven to it by poverty, were you?
Yes, on the whole, it used to be sort of poor peasant women in rural areas who were selling their hair, which would be collected up and used for sort of wealthier women's hairstyles. And that was very, very common in the late 19th century. But even in the late 19th century, in somewhere like Britain and Europe, they were looking abroad to places like China for getting more hair, because there was always this sense that there was a shortage of hair. It's not easy to gather. They call it a crop, but right. You can't sort of harvest it like other crops. It's dispersed on different people's heads, and people have to be willing to sell it.
There is a particular type of hair that is now the world's most valuable human hair, is that right?
I don't know. I mean, European hair is certainly considered, is generally more expensive, partly because it's more difficult to get hold of,
right.
But also because you have a much wider colour range available. A lot of the hair, the vast majority of hair that's on the market is black hair that's gathered from different Asian countries, and it's almost unanimously black, sometimes with some grey or white in it, and so that's less valorized. And also there are different textures of hair that come from different parts of the world. So the Chinese hair is sort of thicker and straighter, and it's said not to hold the curl as well as other types of hair. But on the other hand, it's very resilient to sort of bleaching and dyeing, so it might end up in a blonde wig in the UK.
Right. I mean, virgin hair is hair that has never been dyed or treated in any way.
Exactly. So that's the phrase that's used. And sort of virgin gold would be sort of blonde virgin hair that hasn't been treated at all. And of course, that's difficult to get hold of because many people are dyeing and bleaching their hair. They don't necessarily have long hair in Europe. And also many Europeans don't want to sell their hair, although there is some trade coming in from Russia and Ukraine.
I said it was a secret world. It is actually, isn't it? I mean, there's an example in the book where you visit a very successful Chinese businessman.
Mm.
And I mean, his business, it isn't shady particularly, but it is secretive.
It is secretive. I think there's partly a slight sort of yuck factor that people are slightly repulsed by the idea of sort of a trade in what is really a kind of body part or body product.
It is a body part.
And but there's also, you know, there's a certain amount of shame attached to poverty if you're selling your hair, so you're not going to want to advertise it particularly. And then when you think of hair collectors, they want to sort of keep their sources and supplies of hair, you know, to themselves. So there's a lot of sort of hiding of sources. Then there's in the factories, you know, you've got companies in competition with each other. They might want to keep their particular recipe for bleaching hair, secret. And then even at the purchasing and incorporation of hair, I mean, some people are wearing hair extensions, but they don't want necessarily for people to know about that. So the secret is kind of built in at all sorts of different levels. And even when hair's in circuit, you know, there's a lot of anxiety about hair theft. So right. there's a lot of different ways in which it's secretive.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear two speakers talking about the novella Heart of Darkness. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task. Speaker A.
Sebastian, would you start us off with your choice of a good read?
Yes, I've chosen Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. This is a short novel published originally 1899. Conrad was born in the Ukraine. He was a Polish speaker and learned English, I think, was his third language. And he spent most of his young life at sea, and most of his books are about men adventuring on the high seas in far-off parts of the empire. Heart of Darkness is different insofar as it's set on a river. And the main character, Marlowe, who is a former seaman, is asked if he will take a riverboat up a river in Africa, which is probably the Congo, though it's never actually named. And his job is to relieve an ivory trader by the name of Kurtz, who is deep, deep, deep in the interior of Africa, where he has either gone mad, gone native, or is on the point of dying, or something very strange is happening. And the story is told in very, very highly wrought, very densely coloured prose. Some people have suggested it's because Conrad didn't have a great mastery of English at this point, but I think there's something much more deliberate about it. It's like a painter who layers on layer after layer to get a deep, thick, florid, exotic effect. And really it's about civilization, human beings, what are we, what has colonialism done, both to the colonized and to the colonizer, and it looks deep into what separates human beings one from another, what makes them human, and the darkness that lies deep within the heart of all of us.
Why is the novel so important to you?
I read this first as a student a long time ago. And I'm told by people who teach at universities that no one reads Conrad anymore. So I just thought it might be interesting to look at this guy. I mean, when I was 20 years old, was held up by great critics like F.R. Leibis as being one of the great novelists, along with Henry James, whom, again, no student reads anymore now because it's too long. And I just wondered how it would stand up to rereading. I mean, if we liked it and if we were able to say interesting things about him, maybe people would look again.
Speaker B.
Well, Safras Mansour, how did it stand up to being read by you?
Well, it was interesting you mentioned that you read it when you were a student, because it struck me as a book which probably will have that hold if you read it when you were 20 or 21. I didn't read it at that time. I didn't study English literature at university or anything. The shadow of the book is obviously long. You know, you hear about Apocalypse Now, you know about the horror. You know so much about it without having even read it. I have to say that all the things that you described about in the density of the language, the florid nature, I found it quite exhausting. It's only 40,000 words, but it feels a lot longer. And I also felt, after reading it, I then looked on Wikipedia and other things about this idea that it was a metaphor for colonialism, etc., etc. But I didn't find those things as much in the text as I was hoping to. So it felt like a book to me that you needed to read other things about the book to try and understand it, as opposed to it all being in the text. That may well be the fact of not having studied it analytically, but I found it somewhat disappointing.
Now you will hear the recording again. Speaker A.
Sebastian, would you start us off with your choice of a good read?
Yes, I've chosen Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. This is a short novel published originally 1899. Conrad was born in the Ukraine. He was a Polish speaker and learned English, I think, was his third language. And he spent most of his young life at sea. And most of his books are about men adventuring on the high seas in far-off parts of the empire. Heart of Darkness is different insofar as it's set on a river. And the main character, Marlowe, who is a former seaman, is asked if he will take a riverboat up a river in Africa, which is probably the Congo, though it's never actually named. And his job is to relieve an ivory trader by the name of Kurtz, who is deep, deep, deep in the interior of Africa, where he has either gone mad, gone native, or is on the point of dying, or something very strange is happening. And the story is told in very, very highly wrought, very densely coloured prose. Some people have suggested it's because Conrad didn't have a great mastery of English at this point, but I think there's something much more deliberate about it. It's like a painter who layers on layer after layer to get a deep, thick, florid, exotic effect. And really it's about civilization, human beings, what are we, what has colonialism done, both to the colonized and to the colonizer. And it looks deep into what separates human beings one from another, what makes them human, and the darkness that lies deep within the heart of all of us.
Why is the novel so important to you?
I read this first as a student a long time ago. And I'm told by people who teach at universities that no one reads Conrad anymore. So I just thought it might be interesting to look at this guy. I mean, when I was 20 years old, was held up by great critics like F.R. Leibis as being one of the great novelists, along with Henry James, whom, again, no student reads anymore now because it's too long. And I just wondered how it would stand up to rereading. I mean, if we liked it and if we were able to say interesting things about him, maybe people would look again.
Speaker B.
Well, Safras Mansour, how did it stand up to being read by you?
Well, it was interesting you mentioned that you read it when you were a student, because it struck me as a book which probably will have that hold if you read it when you were 20 or 21. I didn't read it at that time. I didn't study English literature at university or anything. The shadow of the book is obviously long. You know, you hear about Apocalypse Now, you know about the horror. You know so much about it without having even read it. I have to say that all the things that you described about in the density of the language, the florid nature, I found it quite exhausting. It's only 40,000 words, but it feels a lot longer. And I also felt, after reading it, I then looked on Wikipedia and other things about this idea that it was a metaphor for colonialism, etc., etc. But I didn't find those things as much in the text as I was hoping to. So it felt like a book to me that you needed to read other things about the book to try and understand it, as opposed to it all being in the text. That may well be the fact of not having studied it analytically, but I found it somewhat disappointing.
This is the end of Section B.
končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize. Nasvidenje in srečno!